this lecture room, and that's the reason we collect season's tickets outside the door, and we certainly welcome you to join, but the lectures, as you know, are free. Although we usually fill this lecture room, a couple of times a year we have a phenomenon, and we have one tonight. I think we have about five rooms like this, about as full as this, and I think that's a tribute to the speaker we have tonight, Professor Noam Chomsky from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who's one of the world's experts on linguistics. I don't need to tell you that because, you know, he started in linguistics, apparently the Chomskyan Revolution, and that's the reason most of you are here tonight. He's also a person who's written on many subjects. He writes, I think, more than one book a year on many subjects, ranging from linguistics, psychology, the Vietnam War, many other things. But I'm told that he also knows very well how to compartmentalize his activities. And indeed, he's here tonight to talk on the subject for which he is perhaps most reputed, on linguistics, on human nature, the linguistic evidence. I'm very pleased to introduce to you tonight Professor Noam Chomsky.
I'll have to begin by apologizing for the state of my voice. Apparently, since I got here, I've been talking too much and too loudly, and it's beginning to depart from me. However, I hope you'll be able to make out most of what I have to say, at least.
Can you hear that back there?
Any hope? Yeah, okay. Maybe it'll improve in time. The proposition that humans differ in fundamental respects from other organisms in the natural world is hardly open to serious dispute. If an extraterrestrial scientist were to come to study earthly matters, he would have very little doubt on this score. And the conclusion would be particularly obvious if he were to study the changes that occur in the life of organisms over an extended period. The humans of today are, with at most minor modifications, of the same genetic constitution as their forebears many millennia ago. But patterns of life have changed remarkably, particularly in the past few hundred years. This is certainly not true of other organisms except as a result of human intervention. A Martian observer would also be struck by the fact that at any moment of history, there are remnants of earlier ways, even of Stone Age conditions, among humans who do not differ significantly in genetic constitution from those whose mode of life has changed most radically. He would note, in short, that humans are unique in the natural world in that they have a history, they have cultural diversity, and cultural evolution. In these respects, humans are qualitatively different from all other species, and as a scientist, our hypothetical Martian might well be intrigued by the question, why is this so? This same question has, of course, been raised in one or another form since the earliest recorded origins of human thought, a fact which is natural enough. Humans naturally seek to define their place in the world of nature. The question, what is human nature? What is the collection of attributes that so radically distinguish the human species from the rest of the organic world, is a profound and essentially unanswered question of science. It has, in the past, been held to lie beyond the range of scientific inquiry, in that the specific difference of humans lies in their possession of an immortal soul that cannot, in fact, be further understood by the methods of science. Assuming that there are no a priori limits to scientific inquiry, then it will be an empirical question, a question of science, to determine what, in fact, human nature may be. While this is, in the first case, a scientific question, it also is a question that has more than scientific interest. for example, it lies at the core of social thought. What is a good society? Presumably, it's one that leads to the satisfaction of intrinsic human needs insofar as material conditions allow. To command attention and respect, a social theory should be grounded on some concept of human needs and human rights, and in turn on the human nature that must be presupposed in any account of the origin and the character of these needs and rights. Correspondingly, the social structures and the relations that a reformer or a revolutionary seeks to bring into existence will be based on some concept of human nature, perhaps implicit. Suppose, for example, that at the core of human nature lies the propensity to truck and barter, as Adam Smith alleged. In that case, we will work to achieve a kind of early capitalist society of small traders, unhindered by state intervention, by monopoly, or by socially controlled production. Suppose, in contrast, that we were to take seriously the concepts of another classical liberal thinker, Wilhelm von Humboldt, who contends that to inquire and to create, these are the centers around which all human pursuits more or less directly revolve, and who further maintains that true creation can take place only under conditions of freedom, that what does not spring from a man's free choice or is only the result of instruction and guidance does not enter into his very being but remains alien to his true nature, and who holds further, these are all quotes, that human development presupposes social bonds, since the isolated man is no more able to develop than the one who is fettered. Or as Marx, who was, of course, much influenced by French and German Romanticism, would later write, only in a state of community with others has each individual the means to develop his predispositions in all directions. Only in a state of community will personal freedom thus become possible, where personal freedom presupposes abolition of the alienation of labor, which casts some of the workers back into a barbarous kind of work and turns others into machines, and denies what Marx called the species character of humans, which lies in free conscious activity and productive life. On such assumptions as these about human nature, we derive a very different conception of a social order that one should labor to create. And in fact, similar considerations hold even if one adopts the view of some Marxists that man has no essence apart from his historical existence. For even if we were to agree with Marx that, quoting, the nature which comes to be in human history is man's real nature and nothing else, then it still remains true that the next step in social change should seek to provide the conditions under which the real nature can be expressed at a given stage of historical and cultural evolution. Well, I'm not going to pursue these questions, though they are quite interesting. I mention them only to recall two facts of some importance. First, the quest for real human nature is not motivated solely by intellectual curiosity, though in fact that would suffice, but rather it's a matter of deep human concern with significant consequences for social and individual life. And secondly, for this very reason, the question, human nature, is often approached not in the spirit of the sciences, without dogmatic preconception, but rather on the basis of ideological conviction, and often with quite considerable passion. That is understandable, but unfortunate. Precisely because the question does have significant implications for human life, one ought to make a special effort to free inquiry from the chains of doctrine and a priori principle, and to pursue factual inquiry wherever it may lead. How can we proceed to study human nature? A useful point of departure is to note that human nature has a strictly physical component, and we think we know how to go about studying that. Well, how do we, in fact, proceed in that case? A rational approach would be to select some reasonably self-contained physical system of the body, some bodily organ, let's say, and to try to determine its nature. Suppose we've done this in a number of cases, then we might proceed to a higher level of analysis and to ask how organs so studied interact in a broader system, how they grow and develop, and so on. Let's consider the kinds of questions that we might ask about an organ of the body. Take as an example the eye, or perhaps better, the entire visual system regarded as an organ. What kind of questions would we ask about it and seek to in determining its nature? First, we may ask questions about the function of the organ. That is, what does it do, or what is it for? Second, we can ask questions about the structure of the organ. That is, what are the principles in accordance with which it is organized? Third question, following from that, has to do with its physical basis. That is, how are these structural principles of organization actually realized in the physical system, in this case, the physical system of the brain? Fourth, we can ask questions about development. That is, how does the system come to assume its mature form and under what conditions? How do nature and nurture interact, and within what kind of limits in the growth of the organ? And fifth, we can ask questions about evolutionary development. That is, how did the genetically determined aspects of the organ come to be as they are for the species in the course of its development? Well, pursuing these fundamental questions with regard to the visual system, what roughly do we find? Well, we find something like this. We note that we discover that the organism begins in some genetically determined initial state, which we can take to be common for the species, apart from pathology or minor variations, which we can discard. Beginning in the initial state, the organism then passes, the organ in question then passes through a sequence of successive states until it achieves a mature, final, steady state, which then undergoes only very marginal changes through further life. So by some time, rather early, in the early years of life, the organ of vision is essentially fixed in structure, though in fact we can still learn to see in new ways throughout our lives, for example, through exposure to, say, some new form of visual representation in the arts, for example, say, cubism, take a standard example, or by applying knowledge which is gained later in life. The 17th century philosopher Ralph Cudworth put the matter rather nicely in the following way, quote, he said, "A skillful and expert limner will observe many elegancies and curiosities of art and be highly pleased with several strokes and shadows in a picture, where a common eye can discern nothing at all. And a musical artist, hearing a consort of exact musicians playing some excellent composure of many parts, will be exceedingly ravished with many harmonical airs and touches that a vulgar ear will be utterly insensible of." Classical rational psychology of that period assumed that it was the mind, not the physical eye, that was responsible for these more subtle accomplishments. Nowadays, few people would want to deny that some kind of physical change is responsible for the fact that the skilled and expert limner will be sensible of much that escapes the common eye. But still, the essential point that rational psychology asserted can be restated in our terms. That is, we can state that these later accomplishments are based on an interaction of the organ of sight, that is, the eye and the visual cortex, with other organs and faculties that enter into the full cognitive system. It makes very good sense, as an extremely good first approximation at least, to suppose that the organ of vision reaches something like its final mature state rather early in life, though not at birth, and then through interaction with other cognitive systems allows us to learn to see in new and unexpected ways. In the past 10 or 15 years, there's been very exciting and important work on the nature and the growth of the organ of vision, work which I think is extremely suggestive with regard to the more elusive and difficult problem of studying cognitive structures. There's a recent summary in Science, from which I'll quote, of the general character of the results achieved in terms of what's called there a principle of restricted potential, which runs like this, quoting, "The developing nervous system is not a tabula rasa, free to reflect whatever individual experience dictates. Rather, the development of the nervous system is a process sharply constrained by a genetic program. At certain points, the genetic program permits a range of possible realizations, and individual experience acts only to specify the outcome within this range. So, for example, an individual neuron will respond to a line in a particular orientation, but there is some genetically determined range of possible orientations for any particular neuron, and the specificity of orientation is then realized by experience within that range. And similarly, the general character of binocular vision is genetically programmed, but the very precise control of matching of inputs from the two eyes would be determined by visual experience." And these are rather typical observations. During this period, studies of the mammalian visual system have made some progress in determining, in the first place, the general structural principles of organization, and in second place, the physical basis for these principles. And furthermore, they've made some progress in sorting out the genetically determined properties of the initial state that set the range within which experience can fix a particular realization. Those are the second and third and fourth questions that I mentioned. The fifth question is to determine how this genetically determined initial state developed through evolution. That's a fair question, but it's obviously a problem of an entirely different order than that of studying the development of the organ. It's in connection with this final question, with the question of evolution, that questions of function arise in a significant way. No one supposes that children learn to have an eye capable of sight because it would be useful for this function to be fulfilled. The function of the eye is no doubt to see, but that observation is not a very interesting contribution to the study of transition from the initial to the steady state of the organism. Rather, it's in the context of inquiry into phylogenetic development and evolution that functional questions have their real interest, so it would seem. Well, I've mentioned all this because I think that the reasonably well understood properties of the visual system and the success in inquiry into it in these five domains that I mentioned does provide, I think, a suggestive and helpful model for investigation of other aspects of human nature. And in this context, let's turn to my topic, which is inquiry into human language. Exactly how human language is intertwined in some more general system of knowledge, some more general system of belief, that's a question that's been very much debated and is by no means resolved. Nevertheless, it seems reasonable, I think, without question, to abstract away from these interconnections, whatever they may prove to be, and to consider a certain idealization, the idealization of language as a self-contained mental organ, analogous in important respects to the visual system. Notice that when we study the visual system, we begin by undertaking a rather comparable idealization. That is, the visual system is, of course, not divorced from other physical and mental structures. Similarly, if we were to investigate the heart, let's say, we would be looking at that organ from a particular point of view, abstracting away from an intricate web of interconnections. And in fact, the same is true even if we study an organism, a particular organism as a thing, let's say, an individual to be subjected to study independently of the environment in which it subsists. One might, after all, study an organism in the natural world from a very different point of view. One might, say, study the flow of nutrients or the oxygen-carbon dioxide cycle. And if we were to do that, then the organism would disappear in a system of stages of complex chemical processes. It would, in fact, lose its integrity from that point of view as an individual placed in an environment. It's a familiar point. The familiar point is that any kind of rational inquiry presupposes abstraction, presupposes idealization, adoption of one rather than another point of view, putting to the side phenomena that are of lesser relevance or no relevance from the standpoint adopted for inquiry. these moves of idealization and abstraction can be justified only indirectly in terms of the results obtained, the principles revealed within the framework that they impose. I dwell on this point since, although it's taken for granted without any particular discussion in the physical sciences, nevertheless, it's been in the source of a great deal of confusion and regarded as somehow illegitimate in the study of mind. And I simply want to stress that it's not illegitimate. In fact, it's a prerequisite to any kind of serious study. So let me summarize then. When we identify human language as a kind of mental organ, we are not, of course, implying that it is divorced from other systems or that the range of mental phenomena might not be studied or viewed from some other standpoint. Rather, we're proposing a certain idealization, and this idealization will be legitimate if, in fact, it leads to the discovery of principles of some significance and some depth. And in this case, I think there's very good reason to believe that the idealization is legitimate because it does lead to such principles. Well, considering language as a mental organ, what do we observe? Well, we, as in the case of the visual system, we note that each person, again, apart from severe defect, reaches a steady state of linguistic development at a relatively fixed age, say by puberty. Beyond that point, there are modifications, but they seem quite marginal. However, transition from the initial state to the attained steady state does involve quite rapid qualitative changes. Across the human species, the ability to acquire language is fixed and variant within very narrow limits. Noting this, we can assume, as in the case of the visual system, a fixed initial state, genetically determined, that permits a range of possible realizations where individual experience acts only to specify the outcome within this range. At least that would be a very reasonable first guess on the assumption that this mental organ resembles other systems which are known in the natural world. And I see no reason to doubt that, at least as an initial step. Qualitative considerations alone indicate that the range of possible realizations that are permitted by the genetic program must be quite a narrow range. Why is that? Well, in the first place, it's obvious that the final steady state attained is highly complex and articulated in fantastic detail. And furthermore, it's quite uniform across for individuals within what's called a given speech community. Furthermore, it's obvious that the steady state attained is vastly underdetermined by the experience and available to us. Put it differently, we know vastly more than we've experienced, and what is known is quite comparable among individuals in a given speech community. Now, a neutral scientist who was studying humans with no dogmatic preconceptions might well conclude, and should conclude, I think, that language grows in the individual much in the way that the visual system grows. Qualitatively, the two systems seem parallel. And he would conclude then, I think, that humans learn English only in the sense in which they learn to have precise binocular coordination or a particular distribution of orientation specificities for the neurons of the visual cortex. Consideration of the vast scope and complexity and essential uniformity of our linguistic knowledge on the one hand, and on the other, the highly restricted and degenerate quality of the evidence available, suggests at once that the range of possible realizations permitted by human genetics must be quite narrow. On any other assumption, there would be no way to account for the uniform attainment of a very rich and complex and intricate steady state under very weak external conditions. This is as true in the case of language as it is in the case of the analog, the visual system. Well, what about the initial state that we have to postulate? This initial state has to specify a rather limited class of possible languages that can be acquired by humans in the normal way, that can grow in the human organism, in other words, within whatever boundary conditions are set by experience. If the initial genetically determined restriction is sufficiently severe, then it will be possible for the child to attain a system of vast complexity on the basis of limited data, data which is sufficient to rule out all possibilities, save for one or perhaps a few. That is, the child will then know the language which is compatible with his limited experience, though there will be no relation of generalization or abstraction or induction or whatever relating the system attained, which is the attained final state, to the boundary condition set by experience. The child's initial state, then, will lay down the general principles of language structure, providing a schematism of rich and intricate detail, which will determine, in the first place, the contents of linguistic experience, and in the second place, the specific system of knowledge, the specific language that is constrained by that experience. But the relation between experience and knowledge may be, and I think in fact is when we investigate, very abstract. The principles of language structure that are incorporated in the initial state express this relationship, and there is no other way to express it. Once the steady state is attained, then knowledge of language and skill in using language can still be refined, exactly as in the case of learning to see. To my knowledge, Wilhelm von Humboldt, again, was the first to insist that the resources of a language can be enriched by a great writer or thinker without any change in the grammar. An individual can increase his facility or the subtlety of his comprehension of the devices of language, either through his own creative activities, through immersion in the cultural wealth of his society. But as in the case of the visual system, it seems quite appropriate to set this matter aside in abstracting the linguistic system as a separate object of study, which attains its fixed, steady state at some fixed point of individual development. Well, this is rather metaphoric and vague, but we need not content ourselves with these metaphoric and vague proposals. Best what should be done at this point, what can be done, is to spell out precisely the mechanisms, the schematisms that do characterize the initial state. These principles are what are sometimes called principles of universal grammar. We may think of universal grammar from this point of view just as the genetic program. That is the schematism that determines the range of possible realizations, which are in fact the possible human languages. So each such possible realization is one possible steady state which can be attained in principle by a human being. We can call each such realization, each steady state, a grammar, the grammar of a specific language, a representation of the knowledge that we have of that language if we attain it. So from thinking in this way, what has traditionally been called universal grammar is a system which is genetically determined at the initial state and which is then specified and sharpened and articulated under the boundary conditions given by experience to yield the particular grammars, the particular systems of knowledge that are represented in the steady states attained. If we look at the question of growth of language in this fashion, we can see how it's possible for a person to know vastly more than he has experienced, and the fundamental problem in psychology or epistemology is to explain that fact, to explain that we can know so much when we've experienced so little. Well, an approach of this sort stands in rather sharp contrast with more familiar learning models, in accordance with which it's assumed that a language, like other systems, is a system of habits or of skills which is acquired through generalization or conditioning, induction, abstraction, in general in a process of gradual accretion. From this point of view, linguistic knowledge is a system of learned, maybe overlearned, categories and patterns. An approach of this sort can also be made explicit in various ways, and in fact has been, for example, in behavioral psychology and in structural linguistics. So here we have two contrasting approaches. Notice that under either of these contrasting approaches, we have to assume a genetically fixed initial state. The approaches don't differ in that respect. They differ in their conception of what this initial state is, what its nature is. One approach takes the initial state to be a rich system of principles, a restrictive schematism that specifies the range of possible languages. The other approach takes the initial state to be a system of learning mechanisms, of procedures, taxonomic procedures, data processing procedures, procedures of generalization or induction, and so on, which are to be applied to the data of experience to give knowledge of language, and presumably are applied to any other data to give some other system of knowledge. I think it's correct and useful to regard these two approaches as in roughly the form in which I've described them, as modern variants of classical ideas, in particular of classical rationalism and classical empiricism, respectively. Naturally, one can study approaches of a mixed sort, of various sorts, but I think it's very useful to keep in mind these two general models, each of which can have several possible variants as points of reference. Well, the rationalist approach, as I've outlined it, states that the initial genetically determined state of the organism consists of a set of principles that constrains the class of possible systems of knowledge, possible languages that we can acquire. And looking at the mental organ language in this fashion, it conceives of language very much on the model of other known biological systems, in fact, of every known biological system. The empiricist model, on the other hand, sees language as being dramatically different from any known biological system. Now, as I've said, for these reasons, these Piagetian models don't seem to me to be a genuine alternative. And as far as I know, there are no general principles at all within developmental psychology that shed any light on the questions that I've been discussing. So I'm going to put the interactionist-constructivist models to the side, that is, I don't think that they are substantive alternatives, and limit attention to the empiricist and rationalist models and compare those. General principles at all within developmental psychology that shed any light on the questions that I've been discussing. So I'm going to put the interactionist-constructivist models to the side, that is, I don't think that they are substantive alternatives, and limit attention to the empiricist and rationalist models and compare those. I've argued for the rationalist model here and elsewhere, but let me stress that the empiricist models seem much more in accord with our normal way of discussing the development of language. So, for example, we say that the child learns language. We don't say that the child grows language or that language matures. On the other hand, we say that we do not say, for example, that the embryo or the child learns to have arms rather than legs, or that he learns to have a visual system of a particular kind, or that he learns to have, say, mature sexual organs, to take a case of development that we assume to be genetically determined, though it takes place well after birth. And in this manner of talk, we distinguish quite sharply in our normal discourse between the alleged learning of language and the alleged growth or development of physical systems. How seriously one ought to take that distinction, I think, is very much open to question. We also say that the sun rises, but we know why we say that, and no astronomer is much concerned about the fact, and I think we can be equally unconcerned, except to explain with the fact that we speak of learning rather than growing language. In addition to this, it's another relevant fact, perhaps, is that we're naturally impressed with the divergence, the diversity of attested languages as compared with the apparent uniformity of physical organs. And again, I think it's entirely natural that in our normal lives we should take this point of view. Why so? Well, the reason is that in our normal lives there isn't any reason for us to pay any attention to the uniformities among individuals or the uniformities across cultures. These we can take for granted. It's the differences that are interesting. Similarly, I assume that a frog takes for granted that any reasonable creature is like him in interesting respects, and he pays attention only to the differences among frogs. For the scientist looking at frogs, that may not seem so evident. However, regarding ourselves as a frog looks at himself, we too will take for granted the uniformities, and should. It's a waste of time to pay attention to them in normal life, and we'll pay attention to the differences. So take, for example, the situation of, say, learning a foreign language. What do? Well, we concentrate solely on the respects in which this language differs from our own. And a good teaching grammar, a grammar that you'll use for instruction, will say virtually nothing about general properties of language, nor should it. Why? Because these grammars are designed for use by the intelligent reader, and therefore they don't have to provide an analysis of the intelligence that the intelligent reader brings to bear. Typically, these grammars will discuss irregularities, but they will not discuss deeper principles of universal grammar, which are for the most part unknown, and which, even if known, can be taken for granted. They can be taken for granted because we're humans. To bring this down to earth a little bit, let's take a concrete example. Suppose that we're trying to teach somebody English, and we want to teach him, say, how to form questions in English. Well, we would have to tell him that to form questions, he has to, for example, given a sentence like John is tall, to form the corresponding question, you have to take the occurrence of the verb is that appears in it and put it in the front of the sentence, giving is John tall. That has to be taught. That's an idiosyncrasy of English. It's an irregularity, if you like. Questions could have been formed in some other way, and in fact are formed in other ways in many other languages. And a teaching grammar will have to say that. You know, it'll have to somehow tell you that the way you form a question from John is tall is by putting is in front, getting is John tall. However, no traditional grammar and no teaching grammar will bother to tell anyone that you can't take an occurrence of the word is that appears within a relative clause and put it in the front. So, for example, suppose you're given the sentence, the man who is here is tall, and you've learned that the way to form a question is by putting the verb is in front. Well, in that sentence, there were two occurrences of the verb is. The man who is here is tall. But no teaching grammar has to bother to tell you that it's the second one, not the first one, that you prepose. The sentence again, the man who is here is tall. If you were to prepose the first occurrence of is, you'd get something like, is the man who here is tall? Obviously no good. If you were to prepose the second one, you would get, is the man who is here tall? Now, none of these things have to be stated, and I'm sort of certain without inquiry that no teaching grammar ever describes such facts. Probably no one ever thought of bothering to describe such facts. Quite similarly, children who are learning English don't ever make such mistakes. That is, they never say things like, is the man who here is tall? Never make such mistakes. They make all kinds of mistakes, but not that kind. And they're never instructed not to make such mistakes, which is to say that children know without instruction and indeed without experience that it's impossible to form a question by extracting the word is from a relative clause and preposing it, as in the case of is the man who here is tall. In fact, the whole issue seems absurd. And it is absurd. It is entirely absurd from the point of view of normal life. Why? Because in normal life, we take normal intelligence for granted. And normal intelligence somehow informs us, without any specific, you know, without any diversity among languages or among possible systems attained, that there's got to be some principle that, you know, that you cannot extract the verb is from the embedded relative clause. So from the point of view of normal life, the whole issue is, in fact, absurd. But it's far from absurd if you adopt the point of view of the scientist. That is, adopt the point of view of, again, that extraterrestrial visitor doesn't know anything about human beings and has no special insight into human intelligence, and who wants to discover what human nature is. That is, a scientist who's concerned to analyze, to discover, and then to analyze the principles that constitute the intelligence of the intelligent reader. So again, taking this, say, Martian scientist observing humans, suppose that he were trying to understand the transition from the initial to the final state in the case of the mental organ language. And suppose that he's observing people like us and he notices, say, that we form questions and that the way we do it is by taking sentences like John is tall and turning them into is John tall, the man is tall, is the man tall, and so on. Well, what would he conclude? A rational conclusion on the basis of evidence of that sort would be that the way we do it is, this might be a hypothesis that a sensible Martian scientist might propose. He might say, well, what they're doing plainly is taking declarative sentences and finding the first occurrence of the verb is that appears in the declarative sentence and putting it in the front. Well, that's a very, very simple rule. And in fact, it's a rule that works virtually all the time. You'd have to look pretty hard to find a case where it doesn't work. In other words, it's a rule that's confirmed, it's a hypothesis that's confirmed by really quite massive evidence. Of course, we know it's wrong. We know that it's wrong because we can falsify it with sentences like, is the man who is here tall? But, and that sentence, in fact, shows us that we don't prepose the first occurrence of the verb is, but rather, well, what is it that we do? We take the first occurrence of the verb is that follows the subject of the sentence, and we prepose that one. Now, compare two rules. One, the Martians guess, they prepose the first verb is, and two, the actual fact, they prepose the first occurrence of the verb is that follows the subject of the sentence. You compare these two rules and think of them as two scientific hypotheses, and it's quite obvious that the second one, the true one, is far more complex and intricate than the false one. That is, the true hypothesis requires analysis of the sentence into abstract phrases, and notice that those are not physically realized in the sentence at all. There isn't any mark in the sentence that tells you where the subject ends, let's say, or even that there is such a notion. And suppose that our Martian scientist had gotten this far, that is, he tried his first hypothesis and discovered that it was working for a long time, and then finally noticed sentences like, is the man who is here tall, and then got the right hypothesis. Well, if he had proceeded in that way, he would certainly, if rational, want to know why it is that we do it. And in fact, suppose he further noticed that children always try the more complicated rule first. They never try the simple rule. That is, children never make mistakes like, is the man who here is tall? Now, if a scientist, knowing nothing about humans, observed this, he would have to conclude that for some reason to be explained, children without experience, without evidence, are always hitting on an extremely complex and abstract rule and are somehow ignoring a perfectly obvious and simple rule, namely the rule that says take the first occurrence of is and put it in the front of the sentence. And he'd want to know why they do that strange thing. Why don't they ever make such mistakes as is the man who here is tall? Why don't they carry out induction over the simple property first, rather than why do they carry out induction over the far more complicated property first after the subject? Well, that's again, let me repeat, for normal life, this is an absurd question, because we naturally assume unconsciously the properties of specifically human intelligence. But for the inquiry into human nature, in contrast, what is significant is precisely what we never attend to in daily life. And correspondingly, it's precisely what is omitted in traditional grammar, what is omitted in teaching grammar, that is deep and significant from the point of view of inquiry into the nature of language. Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the same is true of the inquiry into human nature quite generally. What is assumed as natural in our daily lives is precisely what demands explanation. Why do we develop the specific cognitive systems that we do? Why don't we develop others that are no less consistent with the data available to us, and that are quite often, as in the case of the example I just gave, much more simple, much simpler than the constructions that in fact we do develop? As far as I can see, to these questions, there's only one possible answer, namely some genetic program determines the specific structures that we're allowed to acquire, some kind of rationalist approach. The constructions that we develop are those which fall within the range of the genetically determined program, this being a program which restricts very narrowly the constructions of our intelligence, and by the same token, permits us to acquire a very complex and, in fact, vast system of knowledge on the basis of the very limited data available to us. So to return to the persuasiveness of empiricist models, we can easily understand, I think, why they should have arisen, why they seem compelling, why people should say learn language rather than grow language. We can, in other words, why one should think intuitively of language as being learned rather than as growing like the visual system or the sexual organs or whatever in accordance with a fixed schematism. The reason is simple. The irregularities of language, which are the only thing that concern us, are learned. Conceivably, they're even learned by the methods investigated in learning theory, though that's more dubious. In exactly the same sense, the distribution of vertical and horizontal receptors in the visual system is learned. We learn how to do the high jump and so on, but we don't learn how to have arms and legs. We don't learn to walk rather than to fly. We don't learn to have binocular vision with analysis of stimuli in terms of linear contours. And we don't learn to adhere to the principle that linguistic rules have to be stated in terms of phrases instead of in terms of linear order of words. All of these conditions are fixed as elements of a genetically determined initial state characterized in some kind of universal grammar. Well, at the outset, when I was talking about the visual system as a model, I mentioned five general kinds of questions that one might raise with regard to an organ such as, say, the visual system. Again, what were these? Questions of function, structure, physical basis for structure, development in the individual, and development in the species, evolutionary development. So that's five dimensions of inquiry. I also noted in the case of the visual system that the first kind of question, that is questions of function, arise in an interesting way in the context of the fifth kind of question, that is inquiry into evolutionary development, not in the context of inquiry into individual growth and learning. Well, I've been talking about language now, and I've only mentioned the fourth of these questions, that is the question of development in the individual. And again, what I've suggested is that the genetically determined initial state limits the range of accessible languages by stipulating a rich and restrictive schematism that these attained languages must meet so that a rich system of knowledge can be acquired on the basis of limited data. Now, let me stress the following point to which I want to return later, namely that there's a sort of a logical relation, an essential logical relation between the scope and the limits of knowledge. Why is that? Well, the reason is that we can attain knowledge of vast scope on the basis of limited data only if the form of the attained system of knowledge is largely predetermined by certain given principles. Otherwise, it's impossible. In fact, otherwise, immense numbers of possible theories, possible systems of knowledge, would be compatible with our limited evidence. We'd have no way to select among them, and we couldn't attain rich and complex knowledge with limited data. So that in order to gain rich systems of knowledge, we have to have highly restrictive principles. But of course, these very same principles that underlie the attainment of rich systems of knowledge will also limit the class of attainable systems. With a highly specific system of genetically determined universal grammar available in the initial state, the child can acquire his vast knowledge of language, but correspondingly, there are only certain kinds of language that he's able to learn, namely those conforming to these principles. It's very important to bear in mind this logical relation between the scope of knowledge and the limits, and again, I'll return to it later on. Well, again, I've talked only about the fourth question, development of language. Let's think briefly about the other questions that are raised. First of all, what about the question of the function of language? Well, it's very commonly argued that the function of language is communication, that the essential purpose of language is to enable human beings to communicate with one another, and that only by attending to this essential purpose can we make any sense of the nature of language. Personally, I find it very hard to make any sense of the argument. What does it mean to say that language has some essential purpose, or in particular that its essential purpose is communication? Suppose, say, that in the quiet of my study, I'm thinking about a problem, perhaps thinking in language, and suppose, say, I write down what I think. Or suppose that someone, say, speaks honestly, just out of a sense of integrity, perhaps fully aware that his audience is going to refuse to comprehend or to consider what he's saying. Or consider, that often happens, consider informal conversation, which is conducted merely for the purpose of maintaining casual, friendly relations, say, with no particular concern as to the content of communication, alleged communication, and so on. Are these things examples of communication, myriad examples of this sort? Well, if they are, then what do we mean by communication in the absence of an audience, or with an audience assumed to be completely unresponsive, or with no intention to convey information, or to change beliefs and attitudes, and so on? It seems to me that we have two choices. Either we can deprive the notion communication of any meaning whatsoever and call all of these things communication, or else we have to reject the view that the purpose of language is communication, because certainly these are perfectly standard uses of language. So while it's commonly said, in fact it's virtually a cliche, that the purpose of language is communication, and while much is made of this alleged insight, I don't know of any intelligible formulation of the idea, so I'd drop it. Well, now let's turn to, are there perhaps more interesting things that can be said about function? Yes, I think there are, and let me think of some examples. A more serious proposal is that certain kinds of functional considerations determine somehow the character of linguistic rules. Well, again, let me take a concrete and extremely simple example from English. In English, we can form embedded clauses, like as in sentences like, say, John believes that it is raining, where the clause that it is raining is embedded. And that clause began with the word that. Okay, John believes that it is raining. And there's a rule of English that tells us that we can drop the word that sometimes. So we can say John believes that it is raining, or John believes it is raining. There's sometimes when you can do it, there's sometimes where you can't. Well, one place where you can't do it is when the clause is in the initial position in a sentence, when it begins the sentence. So if I have the sentence, that John is intelligent is obvious, I can't drop the word that and get John is intelligent is obvious. Okay, that's not a sentence of English. I believe John is intelligent is a sentence of English. John is intelligent is obvious isn't a sentence of English. You can drop the word that in one case, you can't in the other. Why? Well, here's a case where one might suggest, and people have suggested, a functional explanation, and let's think carefully about the logic of that explanation. Suppose we, here's the explanation, which seems plausible. Let's assume that there's a kind of a perceptual strategy that we use in understanding sentences. And the perceptual strategy works like this. It says, find the first noun, phrase, verb, predicate structure that you come across and take that to be the main clause of the sentence and then fit in everything else somehow so it makes sense. Suppose that we use a perceptual strategy of roughly that sort. And then suppose we were to hear the sentence, John is intelligent is obvious. In other words, suppose that English were permitted to drop that in that position. So we could say John is intelligent is obvious. Well, applying this perceptual strategy, we'd be in trouble because we'd hear John is intelligent and the perceptual strategy would tell us that's the main clause. And then what are the words is obvious doing at the end? There's no way to make any sense out of those. So the perceptual strategy would be foiled if we could delete that in sentence initial position. Or to put it differently, the sentence initial occurrence of the word that is in effect an instruction to us which says don't use that perceptual strategy. In contrast, the word that has no comparable function after verbs, so therefore it can be deleted. Well, there's the outline of a theory, of an explanation. Let's suppose that that explanation is correct. If it is, then it accounts for the fact that English has a specific rule of that deletion rather than some other imaginable rule. Now, what does all of this mean? Well, let's think about it. We have to ask the question, is it a genetically determined property of universal grammar that the rule of that deletion has to be restricted to post-verbal position? Or, in the other possibility, is it a fact that has to be learned through experience? These are exhaustive alternatives. And notice that whatever the answer is, in either case, the functional explanation offered applies solely on the evolutionary level. Either it applies on the level of evolution of the organism, if the fact is that the principle is one of universal grammar, or it applies on the level of evolution of the language, if it's not a principle of universal grammar. In the latter case, English evolved in such a way as to facilitate the perceptual strategy, but the rule itself has to be learned. So in this case, in the case of this functional explanation for why a certain thing happens in English, we see that as we would expect from thinking about the logic of functional explanation, that the explanation takes on its significance in connection with the study of the evolution of the system, not in connection with the study of its structure or its development of the organism. And it seems to me entirely reasonable to search for functional explanations of that sort and to think about the processing strategies that might possibly underlie them. However, when we do this, we have to be very careful to distinguish processing strategies from rules of grammar. These are very different animals. The processing strategies are things like the strategy that I suggested, you know, take the first noun, phrase, verb, predicate, and take it to be the main clause. The rules of grammar, on the other hand, these are rules that determine the intrinsic sound and meaning of the sentence. So in the case of the expression, John is intelligent is obvious, the rules of English grammar determine that the sentence is not well formed. If the functional explanation is correct, English grammar has this rule because of a perceptual strategy, but that's another matter that arises on the evolutionary level. Now let's take another case, which I think works quite differently to perhaps sharpen the point. Suppose that you're I give now an example due to Tom Bever, as the last one was. Suppose that you're presented with the following sentence or the following expression. The horse raced past the barn, fell. Again, the horse raced past the barn, fell. Well, when people are presented with that word sequence, they usually look puzzled. I hope you're puzzled. And they usually judge that it's not a well-formed sentence. Let me say it again. The horse raced past the barn, fell. Why? Well, it begins with a well-formed sentence, namely the horse raced past the barn, but then what's the word fell doing at the end? That's the question. Well, if you think about it a little, you'll notice that it really is a sentence, in fact, a perfectly good sentence, and it has the meaning, the horse that was raced past the barn fell, analogous to the horse that was taken from the barn fell, or the horse taken from the barn fell, or the horse raced past the barn fell. Okay? Now, notice that you don't have to learn anything new to understand this. I didn't teach you anything about English to do that, just sort of Socratic method, you know, give a few examples, bring out what you already knew. But on first presentation, the chances are that people would be misled and would think the thing is just some kind of garbage, not a sentence. Why could that be? Well, we might again refer to the very same perceptual strategy that I suggested before, the strategy that says look for the first noun, phrase, verb, predicate, and take that to be the main clause. If you apply that strategy to the sentence, the horse raced past the barn, fell, then you'll take the horse raced past the barn to be a sentence, and you'll be stuck, because what's fell doing? On the other hand, if you get the horse taken past the barn fell, you can't do it, because taken isn't a verb, it's a participle or something. So the homonymity of the verb raced, under that perceptual strategy, will mislead you into getting to a point where you can't assign an interpretation to the sentence. Now what's going on here? Notice that in this case, the rules of English grammar don't guarantee that the perceptual strategy will work. On the contrary, the perceptual strategy will fail in this case. We do have a functional explanation, but the explanation is not for the existence of a certain rule, as in the first case. Rather, the explanation is for the normal misperception. However, we don't have any explanation at all for the rules of grammar. So this case is fundamentally different from the case of that deletion, if the earlier explanation was correct. And there are many other examples which are often lumped together but ought to be sharply separated. They function quite differently. Well, inquiry into function, the first of these questions, leads us to questions of evolution on the one hand, that is either evolution of language or evolution of the species, and it also leads to questions of performance, as in the example that I just discussed. It leads us to consideration, that is, of how the knowledge of the language that is attained enters into the system of processes by which knowledge is used. And notice that study of the steady state that's attained is concerned both with questions of knowledge, what's called competence sometime, knowledge attained, and concerned with performance, that is, use of the knowledge. The questions are very different ones, but they're intimately related. Well, so much for the first question, namely the question of function. What about the second question, that is the question of structure of language, the principles by which it's organized? The knowledge that's attained at the steady state, what I've been calling competence, I've said, can be expressed in the form of a grammar, which consists of rules that assign a sound meaning correspondence to an unbounded infinite number of sentences. Now, it's obvious on any, you know, thought at all that our knowledge of language is unbounded. There's no limit to it. On the other hand, the rules of grammar have to be a finite system. They're represented in a finite brain. So therefore, these rules have to iterate in some fashion to cover an infinite class of possible sentences and fix their sound and meaning. Furthermore, it seems absolutely beyond question that human language essentially makes use of the notion of phrase, as in the example that I gave before about questions. So rules of language apply to phrase structures. Now, the most elementary, rudimentary, simple comment that one can make about language is the following. It consists of a system of iterating rules that are structure dependent in that they apply to arrangements of elementary word-like units organized into phrases. That's the simplest elementary property of human language. Beyond this elementary property, we enter into the really interesting questions of linguistic theory, namely, what's the character of the rules, which unfortunately I can't even begin to discuss here, so I'll stop. So much for the second question. What about the third? The third question, recall, the third natural question to ask after you've outlined the principles of some organ. Third question is, what's its physical realization? How do these principles get realized in the physical structure of the body? What can we say about the physical system in which this abstract theory is realized? Well, in the case of language, for the time being, we can say very little. At a very gross level, there are some things that are known, but they really are gross. So it's known, or at least strongly believed, that language is localized in the dominant hemisphere, which is generally the left hemisphere of the brain. And furthermore, there are some specific areas of that hemisphere that seem to be crucial for language. The little that we know about all of this derives mostly from investigation of aphasia and language deficits. And there is, in fact, a huge literature on the subject, but very few firm conclusions. Now, in principle, one might try to answer these questions by experiment. But, of course, in fact, the ethics of human experiment constrain us and make it impossible to answer the questions in the way that a scientist would do. It's important to bear in mind that this limitation is not a limitation of principle. And again, imagine our extraterrestrial scientist, and let's suppose that he is so magnificently endowed that he regards humans the way we regard fruit flies. Now, for this remarkable creature, it would be entirely clear how to proceed to answer the question, what's the physical system? What would he do? Well, he could conduct all kinds of intrusive experimentation. He could ask how some contrived changes in the environment affect knowledge and use of language, and so on. I mention all this just to stress that there aren't any deep philosophical questions that arise specifically in this kind of inquiry. Rather, the fact is that because of limitations on possible experiment, essentially ethical limitations,